Well, our speaker for today's Paul A. Olson seminar is Robert Matthew Jokel. Matt grew up here in Lincoln and received his BS and MS in geology at the University of Nebraska and his PhD in geology at the University of Iowa. He's a research geologist and associate professor in the Conservation and Survey Division of the School of Natural Resources here at the university, where he works with sedimentology, mineral resources, GIS-based geologic mapping, surface geology and soils, and water service. The title of his presentation is From Fire to Ice, a geological perspective on 1 billion years of landscape evolution in eastern Nebraska. Please help me welcome Professor Jokel.
Imagine my surprise when I planned for an hour-long talk and then I said, no, that's a little long, so this ought to be interesting in a variety of ways, hopefully in terms of content, but also in terms of maybe how many slides we skip over in the process, but we'll try to make it good. I wanted it to come across as somewhat spectacular, but it's sort of hard to do that maybe because most people have a somewhat jaded view of Nebraska, not these people here. I do want to acknowledge some folks, many of whom are in the audience, who've made some of the work that I've done over the years possible by helping me out with it or offering advice. And it's very gratifying to see some of these same people sitting here today putting up with me yet again. Well, back to my idea of a much maligned place, that being Nebraska in general, and maybe specifically eastern Nebraska. Many people think of Nebraska as being at the edge of the habitable world. In some ways, that's probably true, right? In other ways, it definitely isn't true. It's a state that's got a lot going for it, variety of ways. And believe it or not, in terms of landscape and geology, it's a fairly interesting place. You know, when we think about landscape, we think about art, right? And whether we're geologists or geographers or artists, we all draw something important from the landscape. One of my favorite paintings has nothing to do with Nebraska. Sanford Gifford's painting of an Indian summer's day in the Tappan Zee on the Hudson River above New York. Not a very good reproduction, but you get the gist of us. The idea here is when you look at this, you see something that you've seen. We've all seen a lovely Indian summer day, the landscape. Against the setting of that lovely day. And I think probably in the end, a big part of the reason why I'm interested in landscapes, past and present, is because I find the ones that I see today very attractive, very intriguing, very interesting, and they inspire me. And there's a tradition of that, folks, if you know your history. This is one of the Hayden expeditions into the western U.S. in 1870. And right there, we've got two artists and a geologist. We've got Sanford Gifford himself, number one, F.V. Hayden, who was a geologist, among other things, passed away from syphilis, so he did a variety of other things besides watching over geology. And Omaha's own W.H. Jackson, the photographer, was literally yanked out of his studio in Omaha to accompany this expedition. What all three of these people had in common was an appreciation for the landscape, an appreciation for geology, and those things at their most basic, most fundamental level. It spoke to them in a way that sometimes perhaps it doesn't speak to us today because I think we get caught up in the act of doing the science and don't think about what it is about it that really inspires us. Well, when it comes to Nebraska, as I indicated, people have a fairly jaded view of it, right? This might be a postcard from the edge of the habitable world, and indeed it would be somewhat unfair. We might also see a postcard like that, Nebraska, Denver's extended driveway, cut off at the bottom, of course. My day in the sun here, ruined by the projector. I don't know if we can jack it up a little bit more or not. Notice the bug splatters on there. But maybe the best of all, with some apologies to Solomon Butcher here. So many Lutherans, so little fun, right? I'm a Lutheran, and I think I'm a lot of fun, actually, so maybe this isn't quite true. But suffice it to say that when most people think of Nebraska, they don't think of much exciting, and certainly not in terms of landscape. So we might get a postcard like this, greetings from somewhere other than Nebraska. But the truth is, it's not so bad. It's actually quite interesting, especially in terms of geologic history. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is not so much about the modern landscape, but the history of landscapes in general in Nebraska. Nebraska has a history of landscapes going back at least 1 billion years. And in a sense, We're talking about landscape upon landscape upon landscape, superimposed on each other throughout the geologic record that underlies the state. Well, what makes a landscape? First of all, over long-term time, some pretty large-scale processes. Tectonics, the large-scale movements of the Earth's crust, that might even be at the scale of plate tectonics, global scale. Sea level change. Sea level has changed markedly throughout the past 600 million years and even before. Sea level and tectonics together are the great levelers of landscape, as well as the great creators of landscape. Climate. Climate operates on a variety of time scales, like many other things in nature, operates across a continuum. We know there are long-term cycles in climate that have dramatically affected the nature of landscape. Over the short term, especially in terms of how we might view the landscape we see today, in that instant of time in which we live, climate again, smaller scale cycles, water, particularly streams, great carver and shaper of the landscape, glaciers and other forms of ice, including permafrost, which we'll talk about later, and of course, wind. And what makes a landscape interesting? Really, all of this. I could have easily said any of it, because a person could concentrate on one part of one aspect of these 6 points and have an entire career out of it. What's going to follow is a very quick once-over. It won't seem like a once-over by the end, I'm sure, after we've gone through all these slides, but believe me, it is. A very quick once-over, giving you some brief vignettes of the history of landscapes in Nebraska. And here's an example of one of those long-term changes. This is the global sea level curve going back about 600 million years. And if I can do this without burning anybody's retina, there we go. We see that over 600 million years of geologic time, there have been some prominent episodes of high sea level. And these actually left their mark on Nebraska. They left their mark in terms of the materials that were laid down as sedimentary rocks that eventually the landscape was carved from or built upon. We also have an interval of relatively low global sea level for which we have no direct record in Nebraska. Really, as I indicated earlier, sea level and tectonics have gone together to be the great levelers of landscape through geologic time. And that does apply to Nebraska, but in a relatively esoteric sense. And we won't dwell on that too much. I want to talk specifically today about old landscapes, as I indicated. How do we know about them? We know about them because of the sedimentary record, the sedimentary rocks and the sediments that were left behind by processes that took place over the landscape at different intervals of geologic time. We know about them by looking at what happened to those sedimentary rocks and sediments, how they were altered by climate, how soils were developed in them, how other things happened in them, other chemical changes beyond the normal scope of soil development. We know by virtue of dating methods, actually putting dates on rocks and sediments and interpreting what happened at particular times. In a variety of other methods, we could go on, but suffice it to say that there's hard science and there's soft science involved in interpreting modern and ancient landscapes. And I like to do a little bit of both. I guess I'm among the softest of the supposed hard scientists here on campus, but I like it that way. And to cop a quote out of the great Gatsby here, at least the beginning, if Jay Gatsby had been a geologist, maybe F. Scott Fitzgerald might have said this about him. Born back ceaselessly into the past, geologists are haunted by the ghosts of ancient landscapes. And I think that is true. We're always trying to figure out something about the past. That's why I'm a geologist. There's a certain romantic aspect to that. And I might go as far as to say, I guess I'm so romantic about it that I never want to know everything about the geologic past. I never want to know everything about ancient landscapes. I always want some of it to be a little bit mysterious, because otherwise, where's that art? Where's that inspiration? But I may be funny that way, right? In any case, I think something important to bear in mind is that the landscape is like a palimpsest, one of these documents written on parchment, perhaps in the Middle Ages. Parchment was scarce. It was expensive. It's still expensive today. You'd write something on a piece of parchment, scrape it off, write something else on it. A piece of parchment was recycled over time, but you could still see some of the old document through it, right? So a palimpsest is really more than a single document. It's a single document with ghosts of other documents behind it. And, you know, geologists are sort of like monks in a monastery writing on old parchments, right? And the landscape is basically a palimpsest. The modern landscape is. Any landscape we want to take out of the geologic record is a palimpsest. Maybe the entire stack of sediments that sits in the crust of the earth below the surface is in effect a palimpsest, depending on what scale of observation we choose to adopt. Of course, we make mistakes all the time, and I'm really good at making mistakes. I found a few in the process of preparing this talk, and I'm sure we'll find a few more. But I guess that's part of the fun of it, right? Just like faith is not faith without doubt, science isn't science without making mistakes, and I've made so many mistakes by now in my life, I now think of my life as being pure science. In any case, you're a tough crowd to please. Getting back to landscape, though, we find that eastern Nebraska, for as boring as many people think it is actually a pretty exciting place for a variety of reasons, one being that it's right on a major physiographic boundary between the glaciated central lowlands to the east and the unglaciated Great Plains to the west. That's maybe a second-order, major high-order boundary between terrain types in the whole continent. This is a big deal, folks. You cross this boundary every time you go on I-80. It may not be obvious to you, but maybe after the talk it'll be a little more obvious, or maybe not. You can ask questions later. I don't know. But the fact is, it is a pretty interesting place. But this is just the end of a very long story. Indeed, our story going back a billion years. We could talk about this all day. And you can ask my students, sometimes I do talk about it all day, and they're not really happy about it. But hopefully we'll get this done in a reasonable amount of time, and it'll be interesting. Part two of the talk, going back a billion years, hot and bothered, otherwise known as the rift between us. We're looking at this part of Nebraska, deep in the subsurface. We're going to look at a record of rocks recording an ancient landscape that never appears at the surface in Nebraska. In fact, to see the rocks that record this ancient landscape, you'd have to go all the way up to Minnesota, see outcrops around Lake Superior. So we go back about a billion years ago, and we know this, that continents grow over time with plate tectonics, with the accretion of new sediments on and alongside continents, they gradually grow. Continents are built around a shield of old rocks. Around them is a platform on which those same old rocks have sediments deposited on top of them. And in order to see the ancient past that's buried underneath these rocks, we have to use other methods. We have to use remote sensing imagery. We have to drill down 1,000 to 1,500 feet. But there's a story down there deep below the surface. And here's part of how we know about it. We know that there's a difference, a subtle difference in the magnetic signature of the Earth's crust, a magnetic anomaly that runs all the way from the Great Lakes down into Nebraska, down about where Lincoln is. We know this from flying over and sensing magnetic force from airplanes, right? We can literally see by virtue of that magnetic signature through the sedimentary cover that covers the old rocks that underlie eastern Nebraska. And we can see the same thing in terms of gravity. In fact, it's even more obvious in this somewhat accentuated map. We see this difference in gravity, a gravity high, going down all the way from Lake Superior into eastern Nebraska. Well, what is this? It's a rift. It's a place where the crust started to pull apart about 1.1 billion years ago. It's been offset since then by various faults. You can see that it's not a perfectly smooth trend. And Omaha and Lincoln are sitting right on top of this rift. They're sitting right on top of a place where the crust started to pull apart, where perhaps had things been slightly different, or if you're a well-trained geologist, a lot different, we might have had two separate continents forming where there had been one before. Now, all of this business is related to plate tectonics. When we go back about a billion years ago, we realized that parts of Europe, parts of South America, and parts of Africa abutted against sort of the original version of North America and led to the Grenville orogeny, the pushing up of mountains in the approximate vicinity of the modern Appalachians. If you know anything about the history of the Appalachians, you know that there's been a sequence of mountain ranges developed there over geologic time, not just the ones you see today. And we had some far-field effects from that, way over into Iowa here and Nebraska next door. We eventually had this rift develop as various pressures and tensions occurred on the Earth's crust, and as I went the wrong way with the slide advance here. Okay? So the Mid-Continent Rift System goes back to this period of mountain building in the eastern U.S., even though it itself is not part of that mountain building. And we still have a record of it. It's just buried 1,000, 1,500 feet below us. And what happened was something like this. The continental crust started to pull apart, started to undergo tension. When that happened, you had eruption of magmas down in the crack, literally. And that's where the fire in our talk comes from. A billion or so years ago, there would have been volcanic activity in Omaha and Lincoln, and that's about the last time anything like that happened, whether figuratively or literally, right? Well, I don't know. Omaha on a Friday night can be a pretty exciting place, right? Well, we know from drilling holes into the ground across the mid-continental U.S. into this rift that the rift itself is pretty deep. It's filled with volcanic rocks from that extensional episode. We also know that in later phases of development, while the rift was still a hole in the ground, it filled up with water and formed a lake. Here it's called Lake Nonsuch, named for the Nonsuch Shale, a layer of mud that was deposited in there. And it was probably not unlike Lake Natron in Africa today, which is an elongated, enclosed, evaporative lake, probably extended down like that from the Great Lakes again, and probably not too much different from the modern analog there in Africa. Later on, something interesting happened. Instead of the Earth's crust being torn apart, it was actually pushed together a little bit. And instead of an innie, we had an outie. And what had been a hole in the ground, what had been a rift, popped up a little bit. And we had other kinds of sediments deposited alongside of it. Well, a lot of things happened in association with this rift. And we don't want to belabor it too much. But as I said, this is the fire part of our talk, the part we know least about, the part that's deeply buried. But perhaps to many people, the most interesting part. What would the landscape here have looked like then? Well, this is the East African Rift, which is maybe not the best analog, but it's probably the most widely known analog, right? If you can imagine a landscape like this without the multicellular organisms, because a billion years ago, there probably weren't any. There weren't any trees, there weren't any antelope. Heck, as far as we know, there weren't even any sponges, right? We were just on the verge of getting multicellular life, so imagine this landscape with the animals and plants, and maybe you have a pretty good idea of what Nebraska was like. And go and look at Africa and the Arabian Peninsula and see rifts today. You can see the Red Sea, for example, which is not unlike that elongate Lake Nonsuch, that progenitor of what might have otherwise have been an arm of an ocean that developed across the mid-continental U.S., filling in that rift, the mid-continental rift. Well, enough of the distant past. Let's let bygones be bygones and move on several hundred million years and talk about a sea level seesaw in the mountains that never were. All right? And this is where we're going to look, approximately. There's the fickle finger of the Nemaha uplift there, a buried feature under eastern Nebraska. Only reminds me of the many limitations of Photoshop as well as my artistic inability, right? Nonetheless, this is where we're going to be looking next, pretty close to home. Here is an impression of the geology underneath Lincoln, all right? There's the capital for scale, right? About 400 feet high. The old rocks of the rift and associated basement rocks, those old hard rocks that are similar to the ones that make up the Canadian Shield today. They're down on the bottom. These are the sediments that cover it up as part of the platform of which that slide spoke earlier. And these rocks are dominantly marine in origin. So even though we're on dry land today, Nebraska's here in many ways because of a marine past. And we could throw a few dates in there. MA is million years, so the stack of sediments goes back about 400 some million years, right? And at the top, the Dakota Formation, the bedrock immediately underneath Lincoln, is around 100 million years old. Lots happened since then, right? But we only have a partial record of it. And if there were one truism, as it were, about the geologic record everywhere, it's that it's incomplete. And that's especially true here on the platform of the North American continent, where we only have a rock record of an infinitesimally small percentage of all of geologic time. Let's throw in some red arrows just for fun. Those are major time gaps in the rock record, representing tens to hundreds of millions of years, perhaps. Gaps in time for which we have no record of rocks locally, so we're only seeing a piecemeal record of the geologic past here. Let's put more in there. Most of the material underneath Lincoln and above that old basement rock is marine sedimentary rocks, limestones and dolomites, chunks of ancient shallow seafloor. And yet there's some landscapes buried in there because sea level changes over time, remember? So for every up in sea level, there was also a down, right? Towards the top of the pile, the Dakota Formation, which we'll talk about later, is dominantly river and estuarine sediments, still somewhat marine in origin. And over the very top of that is just a thin layer of glacial and wind-deposited sediments, the stuff we live on, the stuff we farm, the stuff we dig up when we dig a hole in the ground. We're really going to be interested in talking about this part of the geologic record as it exists under Lincoln. Sedimentary rocks of the Pennsylvanian system that were deposited during an interval of geologic time in which there were many relatively rapid and relatively abrupt changes in sea level. So sea level was going up and down on a scale of a few hundreds of thousands of years in an almost cyclic fashion in response to the growth and decline of glaciers in the southern hemisphere. So we had landscapes created, landscapes destroyed, landscapes created and destroyed again by rises and falls in the ocean. And by the way, that total geologic record is kind of interesting in the sense that there isn't really that much to it. The thickness of rocks under Lincoln we might think is relatively thick, but compared to a lot of places in the world like mountain belts, it's very thin. And it's really a piecemeal record, right? But nonetheless, we can draw some conclusions from it. So let's go back 300 million years ago and look at landscapes during the Pennsylvanian period, when alternating marine and non-marine sediments were being deposited in North America. This is the position, basically, of Nebraska at the time, about 10 degrees north of the equator, right? We're going to look at this area of Nebraska and talk about a couple of things briefly. Well, we know whenever sea level was high, and this has nothing to do with landscapes, but people always seem to like fossils more than they like rocks, right? Whenever sea level was high, there were lots of scary things floating around in the ocean, like modern chambered nautili on steroids, perhaps. This is one from Nebraska. You could go out and pick one of these up if you spent a week looking around a quarry. This is a thing called Titanoceras, strictly a marine organism. There were also some pretty darn good-sized sharks swimming around in the shallow seas 300 million years ago. But again, we're more interested in landscapes, so let's skip over that and talk about the rocks. When we look at a pile of these Pennsylvanian rocks from 300 million years ago, we notice a really salient pattern, and that is they consist of alternating marine and non-marine strata, primarily limestones and what we would call mudstones, basically rocks made out of mud, made out of clay and silt. Limestones are undeniably marine. They're full of marine fossils, organisms that could only live in the ocean, only live in the ocean today, only lived in the ocean then. The intriguing part to me, since among geologists I'm sort of a weirdo, is what's in between the limestones, right? What's in those basically lithified muds? And the upshot is that they're ancient soils, what we would call paleosols, altered, right, by exposure to the air, by exposure on an ancient landscape, by organisms, by chemical changes, etc. So direct evidence for sea level rising and falling. How? Marine sediments, exposed surface here with soil development, sea level rose again and deposited marine sediments again, time and time and time again. In just the part of the Pennsylvanian section that's exposed in Nebraska and Iowa, there are probably at least 30 to 32 cycles of sea level rise and fall. If you look below that to rocks that are of Pennsylvanian age that aren't exposed, there are even more. So if there were ever an opportunity to examine ancient landscapes one after another, it's here in this pile of sedimentary rocks. And when we start looking at these things, we see some pretty interesting stuff. Here's a marine limestone exposed near Weeping Water, the Aust limestone. here's a red mudstone over the top, mud turned into rock. And it's got a soil developed in it. And at the top of the limestone, you can see these holes going through the limestone filled in with red mud. There's one in close-up. There's an even closer close-up of the fill of one of these things. These are little solution pipes. These are like miniature sinkholes. The only way you're going to get these things is if that marine sediment, the limestone, was exposed to the air for a long enough period of time for rainwater to percolate through it and literally dissolve holes through it. Well, when we take a look at the mud rocks over the top, when we take a look at that paleosalt, we see features in there that are identical to features we'd see in modern soils, maybe some of the modern soils we see right here around Lincoln. And I know we've got a couple of soil freaks like me in the audience, and it's really gratifying to have them here. These are clay coatings along a pore and clay coatings along another pore in this ancient soil. And they're almost indistinguishable from ones you might see in an ice age soil in Nebraska, perhaps. They're evidence that this material was exposed to the air and water moved through it and redistributed constituents just like it would in a modern soil. Doesn't seem like much, but it really is. It's a real epiphany to realize that these units in between these layers of marine sediment show abundant and irrefutable evidence for long-term subaerial exposure, long-term existence above sea level. And there's even more to it than that. We have to step back for a minute and talk about some fairly special features in modern soils. We're going to look at a particular kind of modern soil here, a vertisol, a clay soil that shrinks and swells when it gets wet. And you're looking at this picture of modern vertisol in Texas. I've actually been to this site. If you're standing here looking at this face, your back is basically at the Gulf of Mexico and your heels are being lapped by the waves. This is right on the coast of Texas, around Victoria, Texas. Well, notice right away there's something interesting in this slide. There's some cracks that go vertically, and then there's some cracks that are kind of making arcs through the soil. And when we highlight those, we see that they really make a pattern. This is a close-up of this area up here. These features are actually polished surfaces within the soil. They're smooth to the touch, right? They're slick insides. They're curved polishing surfaces that are created by the movement of soil as it gets wet, starts to swell up, starts to push sideways and upwards in the soil profile. And these particular kinds of slick insides really can only be formed this way. There are other kinds of slick insides that can be formed by faulting in rocks and things like that. But these kind of slick insides that form these bowls, these nested sets of concave upward slick insides, are absolutely unique to soils that form where all soils form, and that is underneath the atmosphere in the bright sunlight and not at the floor of an ocean. It's a really simple but powerful and elegant tool for interpreting paleosols in the rock record. There we have slick insides today. Here's how they form. We don't want to go into a great deal of detail about this, but basically it has to do with drying of the soil, wetting of the clay soil, swelling up of that clay when it gets wet, the clay thrusting out sideways away from cracks that transmitted water into it, right? Develop thrust cones, and eventually that movement, that pushing inside the soil because of the wetting of clays, actually may cause the land surface to have rumples on it, actually may cause what we call gilgai, which is little hills and valleys, a few centimeters to tens of centimeters high across the land surface. We'll see a picture of that. Modern ones again, and look at this. These are 300 million year old slick insides. Every place you see sort of a light surface up here is a slick inside, and here's some here. You can pick them out right away. Perhaps the most striking one is here. See the bowl-shaped set? Another bowl-shaped set over here. They're identical to the ones that I just showed you from the modern soil in Texas. It's a real epiphany to find these. Certainly other people had found these kinds of things before in the rock record, but let's step back and think where we are. We're in a pile of sediments, most of which were deposited in a shallow marine environment, and in fact over the top we've got marine limestone with marine fossils, blah blah blah, the usual story. If we went down deep enough underneath this red mud turned into rock, we would see other marine limestones. So here, prima facie evidence for changes in sea level. A land surface here, not unlike the modern Gulf coastal plain in Texas, and perhaps quite similar in terms of climate. It never snowed, because it was closer to the equator, but probably had wet and certainly had wet and dry seasons in order for these slicken sides to develop in that clay soil. Really, really striking pattern, and as I said, irrefutable evidence for soil development during a low stand of sea level, during a time when sea level dropped. We can trace these out all the way across an outcrop, and we can see set after set of these bowl-shaped slicken sides. We can even see some evidence for that micro-relief, that gilgai of which I spoke earlier. Ancient modern slicken sides in a vertisol, ancient slicken sides in an ancient vertisol. See the peak between two bowls, a bowl there and a bowl there, a bowl here and a bowl there, are essentially identical. And this is what you get if you have these slicken sides forming over a long enough period of time. You get little hills and valleys, sometimes perfectly round, what they call tanks in Texas or crab holes in Australia. There's another example from Mississippi there. Do we see evidence of this in these ancient soils, from these ancient landscapes? And I would argue yes. Here's the top of one of these ancient soils, and here's half of one of these little hills in between the lows, right? And the little low would be over there. This photograph here is a little bit deceiving in that it was taken from below, but indeed, even if you look straight across at the outcrop, you do see that there's a high there and a high there and a bowl of slicken sides in between. So yes, we do see this, and that ancient landscape perhaps looks something like this, although there wouldn't have been any flowering plants on that 300 million years ago. Even when we go 150 feet underground and look at these rocks and limestone mines, we see evidence for alternating high and low sea level. Here we have weeping water 158 feet underground, marine limestone with red mudstone over the top. This is probably an ancient sinkhole developed on top of the limestone. And when we're brave enough to actually spend a little more time looking around underground, we can work most of this out. But even more interestingly, perhaps, there's slicken sides 150 feet underground as well. The top of the marine limestone is shot through with holes from weathering by plants and by rainwater. It's partially dissolved. And it's staggering to think how many of these ancient soils, how many of these ancient landscapes are preserved within this stack of Pennsylvanian sedimentary rocks. It just goes on and on and on. I'm hoping by the end of all this, 10 years from now, maybe I've made a career out of looking at these things, because there's still a lot more of them to look at. And we even see evidence for some of the plants that grew on them. Here's some ancient roots exposed in a quarry near Omaha going down into one of these ancient soils. These are non-flowering plants. We can actually see at least two kinds of roots, perhaps ones like this. These are the same one that grew in a swampy environment late in the development of the soil. And then structures like this that are down deeper in the soil that appear to have been made by a different kind of plant when that landscape was a little bit better drained. So even in one ancient landscape, we see evidence for changing climate or changing hydrology. Oops. Now, I did mention something about the mountains that never were. This is also a Pennsylvanian story, and unfortunately, we'll make this one really brief. Some of you may be aware that if you look at a geologic cross-section along the Kansas-Nebraska border, there's this geologic hernia that shows up, this poking up of those old basement rocks, like the rocks in the Canadian Shield. It sticks way up through the older sediments that originally covered it, and is actually buried by some of these Pennsylvanian age strata. The Nemaha uplift has been described by some people as a buried mountain range. Some of you have probably read some of William Least Heat Moon's writings, and old Billy describes this as a buried mountain range that crossed through Nebraska and Kansas and Oklahoma. Well, it wasn't quite a mountain range, but it had some of the basic ingredients that a mountain range needs. And what would that be? Primarily, that there was geologic structure, that something moved up, that something was broken, that something was deformed. All right? So the Nemaha uplift, guys, is as close as we ever got in Nebraska to a mountain range. And when we start looking along the sides of the Nemaha uplift, we see evidence that there was some relief there, some difference in elevation. These are sediments from about 500 feet below the ground, Pennsylvanian age, around 300 million years old, right alongside of the uplift. And what have we got? We've got big chunks of granite. We've got a granite boulder here that was actually cut through by the coring. You don't normally see boulders in streams in Nebraska. The reason why you see them here is because there was enough relief off this uplift during Pennsylvanian times that streams coming off of it had a higher than normal gradient. And this is probably, when you go back and reconstruct what the geology looked like, this is probably what happened. The Nemaha uplift was a block of basement rock that was pushed up. Sediments were eroded off of it. Probably at the time it had about 100 meters of relief, 300 feet. Not so bad, perhaps. But by the time Pennsylvanian sediments, by the time sea level rose and the uplift stopped and the whole thing was buried by Pennsylvanian sediments, it was probably nearly flat on top. Probably had been eroded off and weathered nearly flat. Well, I thought this talk was about landscapes. So far we talked about as rocks. Well, remember, we talked about rocks as being the record of ancient landscapes. Can we imagine what this ancient landscape looked like 300 million years ago? All these basic ingredients of uplift, erosion, deposition, and burial. If we were to wind all of this backwards, what would we see? We might see something like this. Maybe you've been to Enchanted Rock down in the Llano Uplift in the hill country of Texas, where you've got exposed granitic rock here, kind of a low dome-like structure. We'd probably call it a mountain in Nebraska, but not a lot of relief, pretty scenery, but not a lot of difference in elevation. If there was significant relief ever on the Nemaha Uplift, and mind you, I said about 100 meters, this is probably what it would have looked like, right? Again, the vegetation would have been different. Right, probably some conifers around at the time, like these junipers growing here. But this is probably a fairly good glimpse of what the Nemaha Uplift might have looked like 300 million years ago, except maybe out here, pretty close by, we would have shoreline and a shallow sea beyond that. Next part, and we're getting closer. We're more than halfway through. Rivers old and rivers new. The history of Nebraska is full of stories about rivers. Old and new. We're going to look at these places near to Lincoln. A lot of rivers as big as or bigger than the modern Platte River in the history of Nebraska. We go back 300 million years. We look at the Indian Cave Sandstone, the sedimentary rock that in which Indian Cave and Indian Cave State Park is eroded. And we find out that it was deposited by rivers. We know that because of the cross stratification here that indicates a current going that way. And we have a pretty good idea now that this ancient stream that deposited all this sand, in which the cave at Indian Cave State Park was eventually eroded, probably eroded down at least 30 meters, at least about 100 feet below the surrounding landscape back during Pennsylvanian times. It was a sizable river. It was bigger than the modern Missouri River is today, adjacent to this, down in Nemaha County. And Steve Fishbein, a graduate student here, has actually traced out along outcrops along the Missouri River where the channels were, the ancient channels in this 300 million year old river and estuary deposit. And he's basically figured out that there's more than one Indian Cave sandstone, that there are at least four different positions in which these sands lie, four different stories, four different ancient rivers, all about 300 million years ago. Well, we see a similar motif 100 million years ago in the Dakota Formation. The bedrock underneath Lincoln looks pretty similar. This is the Iron Horse development up at Ashland. Nice golf course there, great old quarry. These are sandstones just like the ones I showed you. When you map these out, you figure out they're filling in an ancient river valley as well, probably an even bigger one than the one I just showed you from 300 million years ago. And we see features like these oscillation ripples that indicate a back and forth movement of water. We see evidence that tidal currents, evidenced by these thin layers of sediment, made their way into some of these ancient rivers 100 million years ago during the Cretaceous period. We also see things like this. This is an ancient log jam. These are carbonized logs squished together by the weight of the sediment, but basically it's a log jam in one of these ancient rivers. And every once in a while, we see an in-place stump, a tree that was growing in these sediments, in these ancient rivers and estuaries back when there were still dinosaurs walking around. We see evidence for point bars. the sides of ancient streams along which sediments were deposited. We see evidence for potholes infilled with boulders in these ancient stream deposits. And when we look at the stones that are filling in those potholes, we see something truly amazing. About 2 in 100 of the pebbles and cobbles and boulders that we see in these ancient stream sediments came from a long way away, came from the Canadian Shield. If you think about it, that's kind of odd, because that means streams 100 million years ago during the Cretaceous period were flowing from the north and the east. Which way do the major streams flow today? Well, the Missouri flows from roughly northwest to south, but the platform flows, west to east. So we have nearly a reversal of drainage over the past 100 million years. Streams were flowing the opposite way back when there were dinosaurs still around. And when we really look at this in great detail, we figure out that many places in eastern Nebraska, we can actually pick out where there were 100 million year old stream valleys filled in with these sediments. And we can map those out, map out ancient stream valleys, and map them out at an even bigger scale. There's Sarpy County, there's Douglas County. This is where we think rivers were 100 million years ago. We have good evidence that there was a big trunk stream flowing this way, coming from maybe northwestern Iowa, flowing down through Council Bluffs, coming across south of Omaha, and flowing at first northwestward here, but based on other information we have, probably eventually turning southward and flowing to Kansas. We also have evidence for little tributaries that flowed from the north and the south to get into the stream. But think of it this way. This is the course of the modern Platte, and it's flowing that way, almost at 180 degrees, at least through this stretch. So here's an example of how tectonics have influenced things. The building of the Rocky Mountains has reversed the sense of drainage in this part of the world. This one's probably even better in some ways. This is a big excavation south of the penitentiary that was there a few years ago. It seemed like a good place to do field work. They said it would be okay to go out there, but they forgot to tell the security guards. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I was in the midst of Cool Hand Luke when they called at me from the tower and said it's time to go. So I never really went back, but basically I was there long enough to figure out that here, in these 100 million year old sediments, exposed by this very convenient trench in the Dakota Formation, Lincoln's bedrock, that basically we had an ancient stream in long section. You could tell that the flow is this way to the west, 90 degrees to modern Salt Creek, and 180 degrees to the modern Platte River. We have evidence for dinosaurs walking around in some of these ancient valleys and ancient river systems, the dinosaur tracks near Fairbury, the only ones in Nebraska. And as we go on in geologic time, we see even more evidence for ancient streams. We know that the eastern quarter of Nebraska was glaciated starting about 600,000 years ago. We know it was glaciated at least 6 or 7 times. We know that there's still plenty of glacial till at the landscape. This is a geologic map of an area south of Lincoln. And we know that on top of that glacial till, there's wind-blown silt called loess. And there's the glacial till underneath it. But I think what's really interesting to us probably at this point is that underneath that glacial till, we have river sediments. We have records of old rivers. And if we start considering local geology, let's say in the Lancaster County area, we've got evidence of a palimpsest landscape, ice age sediments over the top, and basically the remains of ancient stream valleys flowing from the west this time, just like the modern Platte, buried underneath glacial sediments. Why is this relevant? It's where a lot of people in Lancaster County get their groundwater. They get it out of ancient stream valleys buried beneath this pile of nasty clay glacial sediment. And we've known about this for some time. This is the area between Firth and Cortland, right on along the Lancaster-Gage County line. We know from looking at how much groundwater can be gotten out of the ground, and the big numbers mean a lot of groundwater can be gotten out of the ground. The little numbers like 20 over here and 20 up here mean don't even bother unless it's a domestic well. We know that there was some kind of trend like this in the occurrence of groundwater, and basically with further work, we're able to determine that that is indeed that buried ancient stream valley, flowing in this case off to the southeast. And there are lots of cases of this in Nebraska. We've actually been able to fly over this with airborne electromagnetic instruments and get an even better sense for what the subsurface geology is. Some of these results will be published very soon, Conservation and Survey Division. But the staggering thing to me is we think we know about the Ice Age. We think we know about Ice Age sediments from seeing them at the surface being everything from this stream valley upward. But in fact, the record of windblown silt or loess and glacial till is less than half of the total record of Ice Age sediments that's down in these valleys, right? So big deposits of ancient streams, completely buried, unknown to us at the surface except where they crop out locally. Here's another example from the area of Knuckles, Thayer, and Jefferson counties. These colors correspond to the elevation of the bedrock surface, and this is a buried bedrock surface. The red and orange colors mean higher elevations. These yellowish colors and greenish colors mean lower elevations. We start tying these together, and look at that. Down underneath, pile of all this Ice Age sediment on the top of bedrock, we've basically got a network of ancient stream valleys carved down into the bedrock. And you know what? It's quite unlike the pattern of modern drainage. There's the modern Little Blue River going that way and an oblique angle to all this drainage going from west to east. These are preglacial drainages probably. Some aspect of it could be interglacial, but for the main part, these are streams that predated glaciation. Interesting point is that previously some geologists in Kansas basically referred to this stream system here as a trunk of the ancestral Republican River. So the Republican in some ways is one of the oldest rivers in the entire region. And here's potential, what's that?
The guys in Kansas want it back.
Yeah, this part they don't care about so much. Even though there's no surface water in there, guess what's in there now? Groundwater, and there's a lot of it. And a lot of people doing agriculture in this part of the world rely on these buried streams to get their water source. I'll skip over that. We're going to burn through this one pretty quick, too. We're all getting restless, but I had to throw this in. Kind of an interesting story, perhaps an unexpected story. A landscape that has something to do with gems, huh? We go back 12 million years ago. We can see that in the Ogallala group, these sands and silts and such that make up a big part of the High Plains aquifer, locally, it's cemented with silica. Right? These hard ledges are cemented with silica. And if we look at that silica cement in detail, we find out that it's basically opal, right? Well, you couldn't necessarily sell it, but it turns out there are places where you do get chunks of precious opal in the Ogallala. Here's a place you maybe never heard of, Lookout Mountain in Franklin County, Nebraska. It's what passes for a mountain in Nebraska, right? It's a high point. Top of it is this silica cemented sand at the base of the Ogallala. How did it get there, this opal cemented sandstone? Now, a lot of this material was mined in the early 1900s. Some of it was used to pave streets in Lincoln. Some of the silicification goes down into the underlying rocks, down into the Niobrara Formation, even older Cretaceous Age sediments. And we start looking at that silicification down at the base of the Ogallala. We start looking at the opal there. We see that there's a very complex pattern of features, convoluted bedding, places where the bedding was upturned like this, pushed upwards, this Lisagong banding, which indicates that solutions infiltrated into the rock carried silica and iron compounds with them. When we look at it under the microscope, we see coatings of both opal and chalcedony, two varieties of silica that are used as gemstones, and this rock is just loaded with it. We see coatings of this kind of opaline silica. We see evidence that the rock itself was partially dissolved, partially impregnated with silica. These solution pipes here. And a variety of other interesting features that we'll burn through a little bit maybe here to get through the good part. This is a rock literally impregnated with opal. And in some places, you can actually see in openings or vugs within the rock, this nice, beautiful, bluish, milky opal. There's even some iridescent opal. It's not quite gem quality, but it's close to it, and it's really pretty stuff. Well, how did all this happen? Well, I think a good analog to this is in Australia. You've heard of opal coming from Australia. We have something like that in Nebraska. These profiles of opalized rock that are so prominent in the opal fields in Australia are actually very similar to what I just showed you in the Ogallala group in Nebraska. How did it get there? Well, basically, there are a number of features in common between the features I showed you in Nebraska and in adjacent parts of Kansas and in those opal fields in Australia. And what it has to do with probably is some kind of reaction that's taking place with groundwater, okay? All of this was buried down at the bottom of another ancient stream valley. That groundwater had dissolved silica in it. That silica was precipitated out in those rocks as opal. And basically what was now a high was originally a low down at the bottom of a stream valley where groundwater was percolating through, reacting with the rocks, and leaving behind this opal, leaving us eventually one gem of a landscape. And basically what's happened is topographic inversion. That cemented structure at the top of Lookout Mountain was in the bottom of a river originally. Everything else around it did not get impregnated with silica, and it was left behind by later erosion. I think we're going to skip through this part, because I can tell I planned for an hour and a half. Look at all this good stuff we'll miss. We'll save that for another time, right? Hate to let it go. One more. We have to do this one. Cold and creepy. We're going to skip ahead all the way to about 18,000 years ago, the last glacial maximum, give or take. We're going to go back to Jefferson and Thayer counties. We're going to look across the margin of the glacial limit, across the maximum extent of glaciation in this part of North America between about 600,000 years ago and 2.5 million years ago. When we were doing geologic mapping in this area about 4 years ago, we saw some interesting things in rock outcrops. There's an outcrop of the Greenhorn limestone, Cretaceous in age, goes back to the end of the near the end of the age of the dinosaurs. And these are layers of limestone that were originally flat-lying, and now they're contorted into these really tight, even overturned folds. Here's a layer of altered volcanic ash in there that's also bent up. And this is odd. Normally, in most people's geologic experience, this would result from tectonics. It would result from the crumpling up of that rock because of pressures inside the Earth's crust. But as we started to look around, we realized that there wasn't any evidence for any of that happening in this part of Nebraska. And indeed, rocks below this were not crumpled up. It was only rocks right at the land surface, within about 6 to 10 feet of the land surface, that showed this kind of crumpling. It was odd, and some of the rock was brecciated or broken up. Chunks that should have originally been horizontal were now vertical and resting at all different kinds of angles. The more we looked at it, the more we realized there was a real pattern to this. Every time we saw a big fold or a big crumple in the crust, and here we have a layer of this limestone here, dark, offset by a little fault, same layer, offset. Every time we saw this kind of thing, it was always in accordance with a modern slope. In other words, everything was folded downslope according to the modern slope. If we went uphill on this hill and down the other side, guess what we'd see? We'd see folding and crumpling going the other way. That and the fact that all of this was near to the surface told us this had nothing to do with geologic structure, nothing to do with pressures on the Earth's crust. It had to do with gravity. It had to do with things moving downslope along something like the hill slope that we see today. Many examples of it, all of it trending downslope. Here's another example where layers of rock are dipping downslope. Here's the lower part of that slope, and we actually see chunks of material that have been faulted downwards relative to the slope. When we start looking at the landscape, we realize to the north of here, we're on the other side of the glacial limit, flat as a pancake, heavily glaciated. But where we actually see this crumpling of layers of rock, it's pretty rolling landscape. It's directly on the other side of the glacial limit. What does that mean? This was never actually covered by glaciers, but when it was cold during the Ice Age, and it was cold many times during the Ice Age, colder than today, this landscape still got frozen, right? It may not have had a layer of glacial ice over it, hundreds of feet thick, but it still got frozen. And when we look at the landscape today, here's a satellite image draped over a digital elevation model, we really see a difference. This is the glaciated terrain that's relatively flat. Fairbury, Nebraska is down here. Here's the Little Blue River, basically the glacial limit. We go up south of Rose Creek to where we see this kind of crumpling of rock, and there really is a high there. There really is some relief there. You can see this going down Highway 15 south of Fairbury. And basically, what it amounts to is there's an ancient preglacial stream valley filled in with sediment that trends this way towards the east underneath all that glacial sediment. And this high area we've called the Rose Creek Escarpment is actually the ancient valley wall of a stream that was there maybe as long ago as 2.5 million years ago. So this is one of the oldest landscape elements, I think, in eastern Nebraska. It's an ancient valley wall that's been sitting there for a long time. It was sitting there when the maximum extent of glaciation was right over there, just a short distance away, right? And there's our Paleo Valley, of which I spoke earlier, and all this crumpling along slopes is occurring right along here. Well, what this amounts to is, it's nothing to do with with geologic structure, as I said. This downslope movement and folding of these thin layers of rock had to do with the presence of permafrost, had to do with the ground being frozen permanently, like we see in high altitude areas like this area in Kyrgyzstan here. And the top of the permafrost melted periodically, so you had saturated conditions. You had that soft bedrock and soil. It was charged with water sitting on top of permafrost that never froze, not even seasonally. And what happened? Every time it thawed during the summer, back in the Ice Age, the whole surface soil and the soft bedrock underneath started to slide down slope, a process we geologists called solifluction. And here we see evidence for that in a modern landscape that has permafrost underneath it. You can see where sheets or slabs or rolls of surface soil and shallow bedrock have literally broken loose and slowly creeped down slope. Really, it's the only way to explain those structures that we saw. So what originally looked to be something nondescript, uninteresting, turned out to be very interesting, and it turned out to give us some clues into the geologic past that we didn't have otherwise. Bill Wayne is in the lecture today, and he can correct me on this, but as far as I know, this is about the farthest south we've seen paraglacial effects in bedrock in Nebraska, and we really had no idea it existed before. Maybe he did, and he's going to tell me about it in about 2 minutes here when I'm done. I guess this is a good story to finish up with in the sense that many of those other stories I told were pretty expansive. They involved immense amounts of time or really striking features, and we ended up with something that was relatively small in scale, but nonetheless made a very powerful statement. So it demonstrates to us that there's always room for observations in geology. And by now, considering my poor planning, considering my trying to put an hour and a half's talk into whatever, an hour or whatever it's turned out to be, considering your patience and everything else, we're now at part, who even cares by now? So there aren't going to be any real conclusions, but I am going to offer you a parting shot. One of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite characters in American letters, Dorothy Parker, kind of interesting person to quote maybe in a geology talk, but I think it sums up how I feel about geology, studying landscapes old and new. The only cure for boredom is curiosity. All these things we talked about required curiosity to get at them. Maybe the most curiosity was required by that last case where we saw these cruddy, strange features in corrupt little outcrops in the middle of nowhere, and actually were able to tease a really interesting story out of them. That curiosity is great. There may be no cure of it, but you know, dogma is another thing entirely, another quote from Dorothy Parker. Believe it or not, some of what I told you involves a good deal of dogma, whether my own or somebody else's. And it illustrates another beautiful point about geology. And it is, there's always room for new ideas. There's always room to overturn dogma. And maybe when you have my young colleague Paul Hansen back, I hope he'll come here to talk in 2 years or so, extend him an invitation. He can overturn some of this dogma and give you the straight dope about landscape evolution in Nebraska. But for now, I'm done. I appreciate your patience. I hope you've learned something. If nothing else, unlike most of my classes, I've been able to keep most of you awake. And that's always a good point. Thank you very much.